Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. What is up, crew? Welcome back to the show. We have got back into a quick read today. And this one is another one by, we just recently did the Independent Property Rights episode, which was The Skeptic's Guide to Bitcoin Part 3, that series. This is not a part of that series, but it's by the same authors, Hasu and Suzu. And this one is Bitcoin is a Hedge Against the Cashless Society. This is kind of a decent introduction to a much longer work that I am going to be covering, I think, next week sometime. I will be starting it. It will likely be three parts, at least at certain. I mean, maybe I'll just go for the long haul and hit it in one or two. But we'll see when I get around to it here next week. So for the meantime, we will use this kind of as our introduction into that conversation about the cashless society and the benefits of privacy and electronic cash. And we will use Hasu and Suzu's great little piece. And this is a short one, so we'll be able to hit this really fast. And we'll use this as an introduction to that because I want to kind of expand on this conversation quite a bit for the next week. It won't be all that we're hitting, but I really love this discussion. You know, privacy is really important to me, and we've had a lot of episodes on privacy, and there's a lot going on that front right now. And I think it's I think we've kind of been preparing for this, but I think this is going to be the next big challenge of Bitcoin. I think if Bitcoin does not achieve sufficient privacy, which our recent Schnorr article talked about, if we don't get sufficient privacy on the base layer, it could be a very, very difficult proposition, and it could threaten both the fungibility as well as the sovereignty of using Bitcoin. I don't think it would kill it, but I think it would greatly increase the complications and the ability to enact controls to basically use the public nature of the blockchain against innocent people, against people who have done nothing wrong. So because of that, I don't want to lead the article too much or have the conversation before we dig into this. So let's go ahead and jump into their article, yet again titled Bitcoin is a Hedge Against the Cashless Society. Quote, when cash is gone, where will you turn to transact with a basic level of privacy? What money do you hold when negative interest rates start eating away at your bank account? End quote. The rise of digital payments and the move towards a cashless society are often seen as the same thing, but there is an important difference between them. Digital payments like PayPal, Venmo, domestic and international bank transfers are convenient for people and businesses to transact with. They represent fintech innovation to consumers by the market. Faster, cheaper, and more efficient forms of digital payments are uncontroversial and largely an engineering and marketing challenge. They don't, however, remove every need for cash. Cash has unique properties that digital payments have not. As physical coins and notes, it can be exchanged peer-to-peer without a middleman. Its ownership is transferred simply by handing it over. The absence of an intermediary ensures that transfers are permissionless, censorship-resistant, and most importantly, private. Digital payment solutions do not utilize physical cash, but also do not prevent anyone from continuing to use cash if they want. It is an alternative payment method to cash, but it is not antithetical to it. Indeed, in almost all modern societies, there coexist both a large digital economy and a large cash economy. We will argue that the elimination of cash, even if most payments are already digital, will make society more vulnerable to surveillance, financial control, and authoritarianism. Why do countries go cashless? In a cashless society, the government seeks to discourage or even criminalize the holding and using of cash itself. In Sweden, it happened largely without coercion. In India, the government demonetized the 500 and 1,000 rupee denominations of notes. Different countries can have different incentives to push for a cashless society. In China, digital payments are primarily a tool of social control and serve as a backbone for China's social credit system. And they are making progress on it. 96% of cash payments in 2012 have turned into only 15% in 2019. Over in Europe, central bankers are enthralled by the idea of negative interest rates. A recent IMF report states that, quote, "Severe recessions have historically required 3 to 6 percentage points cut in policy rates. If another crisis happens, few countries will have that kind of room for monetary policy to respond," end quote. Negative interest rates were traditionally hard to implement because cash served as a lower bound. In a cashless society, this lower bound would disappear. In a severe recession, the central bank could drop the policy rate to, say, -4% to make consumption and investment more attractive relative to saving. Recently, central banks have started to brush everyone who prefers cash with the label of a criminal. They do that by separating the uses of cash into legitimate and illegitimate. People, quote, abroad can hold cash, quote, legitimately to replace an unstable or inflationary currency. Now, domestically, the only beneficiaries of an anonymity-providing currency are, quote, those engaged in tax evasion, money laundering, and the financing of terrorism, and those wishing to store the proceeds from crime and the means to commit further crimes, end quote. Indeed, the use of cash in larger denominations has become so stigmatized in the U.S. and Europe that withdrawing or carrying above a certain amount requires explicit government permission. Problems of the cashless society. A society without cash has no ability to transact value without the omnipresence of government actors. By going cashless, societies double down on the properties of digital payments, but lose all access to the unique properties of cash. If every payment is intermediated, it becomes impossible to pay someone for anything without there being a record somewhere. It eliminates privacy and places the government as the third party in every financial event. Governments claim that a cashless society enables them to protect citizens from criminals. The specters of terrorism and organized crime are often cited at this point. But this makes the naive assumption that government itself can never become evil. Because all transactions require the consent of an intermediary, they can easily be censored and funds confiscated. It might not be happening right now, but a good monetary system should be robust to changes in political moods. A cashless monetary system is less resistant to both the tyranny of the majority and shifts toward authoritarianism. Cash may not be the right tool for the majority of transactions, but the elimination of it removes an important choice and safeguard against government abuse for the people. Bitcoin as a hedge against the cashless society. When cash is gone, where will you turn to transact with a basic level of privacy? What money do you hold when negative interest rates start eating away at your bank account? Traditionally, it has been impossible for the private market to come up with solutions for these basic human demands. The state doesn't like competition to their own fiat currency and made sure to quickly shut down all attempts of other monies to enter the market. Bitcoin could change that. decentralized and digital in nature, it no longer has the central point of failure that made previous private monies vulnerable. And it is modeled to marry the two forms of money, physical cash and digital payments, in an entirely new breed, digital cash. It can be transacted peer-to-peer, is permissionless, does not censor people or transactions, and has a reasonable level of privacy if one knows how to use it. We are still early into the Bitcoin experiment, but with the cashless society looming on the horizon, we more than ever need it to succeed. Its fixed monetary policy already makes it a hedge against high inflation. That is increasingly used in places with collapsing fiat currencies like Venezuela. But equally importantly, Bitcoin is a hedge against the demonetization of cash and the rise of the cashless society. All right, let's hit our sponsor real quick, and we will come right back, and I want to discuss this and kind of our introduction to the whole cashless society problem and electronic cash in general, and we will hit that in just a moment. All right, so I hope you guys enjoyed that article. Again, that was by Hasu and Suzu, and it's called, or it was titled, Bitcoin is a Hedge Against the Cashless Society. And I think they kind of hit the overview of like the major risks of a cashless society. And I think this is a really good introduction into that conversation that we can have going forward. Because I want to talk about this. I want to talk about this in a couple of different contexts. It's interesting. There is a deep, deep naivety in people who think that when there is no check on government control over finances or invading people's privacy or essentially confiscating their wealth, that with no check, that they'll still just be honest. That's not how incentives work. If they have the incentive, if they can do it and get away with it, they're going to do it. Like, corrupt people will gravitate towards that, and that will be how they make money. There was just an article the other day of somebody, like police chief in New York or whatever, spending $350,000 on a bunch of nonsense that was civil asset forfeiture, and which is civil asset forfeiture, for those who don't know, is suspecting that some funds or capital has been used, and capital including a house, somebody's car, cash, that it has been used in a crime, not being able to identify, not charging anyone, particularly not charging the owner. This is explicitly confiscation in the place, like in a time where there is no charge against anyone, but to confiscate the actual wealth, the funds, to steal it from someone because you suspect it could have been used in a crime. There's the cases of this. The fact that this is not heard, like you don't hear this on the mainstream media, is mind-boggling. The cases of this are absolutely disgusting. And the police stations or like districts or whatever, they actually spend this money like it's funds. Like they just got, like there was a case of a young kid, I don't know, 17-year-old or something like that, having a little bit of cocaine in his room, and the police station confiscated, and this is in their parents' house. They confiscated the house under the suspicion, even though he didn't even have the limit, the amount of drugs that would suggest that he was a drug dealer, under the suspicion that he could have been a drug dealer. No evidence, no charges for this. And nothing against the parents. The kid didn't own the house. They confiscated the house, sold it, and used it to buy a bunch of stuff for the police station. And the parents never got their house back. They were stuck in court trying to defend an object against the suspicion of a crime, an inanimate object. This entire thing is absolutely ridiculous, but it's a perfect example of, like, people think Like, the U.S. government is honest, but it's not about... The government isn't a thing. It's a group of people who either have the accountability of paying the cost of their actions or don't. What people in like a policing institution are a monopoly. They are the institution that the customer cannot refuse. I can refuse to go to Walmart. I can just shop somewhere else. I can refuse to shop at Apple. I don't even have to buy internet if I think the price is ridiculous. All of that is a giant hedge against any of those companies doing something absolutely retarded, like stealing my house because I didn't pay my internet bill this month or something ridiculous. But if a government or police station or something just happens to do this, even if they have no basis, you're immediately stuck in a multi-year legal battle that's going to suck so much of your life up and require you to pony up vast amounts of money that you will probably never get paid back for all because the government had the assumption that whatever they do is honest. It's an incredibly dangerous mentality. And it's exactly things like the cashless society. It's exactly removing the loss of privacy is exactly the kind of thing that empowers and emboldens this type of behavior from those exact institutions. It's an incredibly dangerous thing. And, you know, the Hasu and Suzu are very, like, I guess you could say, reasoned about it. Like, you just kind of hit that, you know, the incentives are out of line. And how do you protect yourself from negative interest rates? And, you know, we could go into the fact that, and maybe we should, that negative interest rates aren't even something that will get us out of a recession. A recession is caused because we have indebted ourselves to a degree that we cannot pay off at the interest rate. So what you are doing is, by instituting a negative interest rate, is that you are punishing anyone who is saving, when saving is exactly what the economy needs to get back in balance. This is why, if you look at the debt cycles of the last, you know, 30 or 40 years, and comparing it to a chart of total debt in the economy, is the debt has just gone massively, just grown and grown and grown. And every single time we had a recession, that recession is critical. The recession is telling the market that we have overextended ourselves, that we have spent too many resources and made too many plans that we do not actually have the capital to accomplish. Therefore, we should stop going into debt and we should start actually paying stuff off and saving for the future. If you don't have savings for the future, you're not going to be able to build anything for the future. You can't build a house with trees you haven't cut down. Like, if you don't have any lumber, you shouldn't be building houses. What a negative interest rate does is encourage people to keep building houses even though the economy has already told us that we are out of wood. So the prices continue to skyrocket. The price of housing skyrockets. The price of healthcare skyrockets. Everything that people start going more and more in debt to accomplish, the higher those prices go, and anybody who is saving for the future is being obliterated with it. That negative 4% interest rate is to anyone who has earned money and is trying to keep it so that we can use it in the future to have sustainability and actual production in 10 years as opposed to right this very moment, because we've already just ridiculously overconsumed. And I think that's a really important, that might not follow for somebody who is newer to the ideas and concepts of money. But there's I do an analogy that I think does a really good explanation. Money is not a resource. Money itself is not a resource. It is a tally system to allocate who has access to resources. And it is specifically a tally system to keep track of past favors, past voluntary favors. If the exchange was dishonest, then that's where it is not, that's where it's not accurate. But that inaccuracy is inevitable when people can easily remove funds from someone else. So if someone steals $1 million, you'll notice they do not spend it the same way that somebody who has started a business and worked their ass off for 9 months and happens to have seen success and has made $1 million. And anybody who has saved, this is the important thing, is anybody who has saved $1 million, just think about it in the context of your own life, that if you save $1 million, what does it mean for what you have done? What was your process? What it means is that you have created, you have done $1 million worth of work for somebody else. Let's say what you do is fix cars. It means that you have repaired $1 million worth of car damage for the economy, and you haven't asked for anything in return. You've done $1 million worth of value in favors to other people. You have produced that into the economy, and you have not removed it. So an institution that is manipulating interest rates into negative territory, let's say negative 4%, the example we have in this article, if the interest rate becomes negative, that means that they are stealing from the person who has provided $1 million worth of value into the economic pool. They're stealing your $1 million, all your hours of blood, sweat, and tears fixing cars and eating ramen noodles instead of a steak dinner that you have saved. They're stealing that time from you so that the person who borrowed it without providing anything for the economy, saying that I will provide something in 5 years, or I will pay this off over time so that they do not have to pay you back. It is a giant reallocation from the people who are actually doing stuff to the people who are consuming it and not returning it. Savers are one of the most critical things to a healthy economy. If we do not have resources for tomorrow, we cannot do anything tomorrow. A negative interest rate is one of the most dangerous things a central bank can do. But who does it benefit? It benefits the largest debtors, the government and the central bank. If you go into massive debt, you can pay it off really easy if you can pay yourself 4% for going into debt. Think about that. I am both going to take value that I have not earned. I am both going to take your labor and your production in your life that you have not removed from anybody else. I'm just going to take your surplus. And then I'm going to, every year that I don't pay you back, I'm going to owe you 4% less. I am going to decrease how much I owe you over time. You know, even if that was some stupid way to actually boost the economy, I don't care. It's antithetical to society. Literally, the nicest way of putting it is that it's a scam. And that a cashless society makes this frictionless. Should scare the crap out of anybody who doesn't immediately trust that their financial system and the banking and central banking and government institutions are just the greatest, not just average, normal, I want to do good people, because they could be good, they could still want to do good and just be incredibly ignorant. Like, think about it. They could just think negative 4% is accurate, is the way to save the economy. I mean, a lot of people do. So they don't even have to be malicious. They simply have to be wrong, which is pretty much everybody. The mass majority of everybody is just generally stupid about most things. That's the brilliant thing about the economy and about voluntary exchange, is that we get to specialize. I get to spend my life learning and talking and discovering about economics and Bitcoin, and then I trade that value with other people by sharing the short version of that, the summary of it. Well, I'm not making a lot on that at the moment, but still, I'm able to do that at the moment. And so to say that, it's not even about whether or not they are malicious. It's about whether or not they have the power to be wrong and you do not have the power to be right in their stead, that you are forced to fund their inaccuracy. Falsehoods have consequences. Falsehoods are real things. You can't just, that's what makes them a falsehood. If you live and act on false information, you you create disharmony, you create destruction in the world. And so, again, whether or not they are malicious or not, it causes massive disruption. It causes incredible destruction inside the economy. And without any way to hinder their ability to do this, they do not get punished for them being wrong. Everyone else does. They still have the reins on the printing machine. They still get to print money. And if it doesn't go right, they can just blame it on everybody else. That's what they do every time. Oh, the market sucks. Oh, the market is stupid. It's like, you're the same people. Why should I think that you're not wrong when nothing went the way you thought it was going to work? And if there is no friction, they will just keep doing it. That is the end game danger of a cashless society. Negative interest rates, the complete lack of privacy, no hindrance to, the civil asset forfeiture is in the many billions of dollars a year now. Billions of dollars taken from people who have never committed, who have been charged with no crime, nothing. They didn't require evidence. They didn't require a court case. They didn't require a warrant, nothing. They needed a warrant to confiscate the house. They needed a warrant based on suspicion that the inanimate object was a criminal. And it's just utterly ridiculous. I get a little heated about this. So, you know, like, take my passion with a grain of salt. But a cashless society is an absolutely dangerous thing. It is literally the dystopia that that Bitcoin made me happy to think we could actually avoid. It is a hedge. It is a hedge against this. Because negative interest rates are coming. Every major banking institution, governments and central banks alike, have been preparing for it. You can see them setting the stage. They've made the laws that make it legal. It was in the just after the 2008 financial crisis. I can't remember which bill it was exactly, but you no longer own the money in your bank account, so they don't actually have to pay it back to you, and it certainly does not have to hold its value for any reason. But what a bank deposit used to be is they were custodians of your funds. That's the way it's always been. That's why they originally had to pay you gold if you came asking for it. And so fractional reserve was a scary thing because it meant that, you know, they were promising there was $1 million there, even though they only had $800,000 in gold. That was the whole purpose, this whole design for banks, is you're giving them your money to keep safe, and it's yours under their custodial control. That's no longer the case. A bank deposit is now a loan to the bank. So you are liable to the problems of the bank. So if the bank goes insolvent, they don't have to pay you back. They just go insolvent and then they say, I'm sorry, we only had $1, one actual dollar in relation to the $2,000 you had in your account. So here is the remainder, the central bank prints it and then just gives everybody pays off liabilities or something, and you just have huge inflation. But who knows? Who knows what's actually going to happen? But they're clearly preparing for negative interest rates and haircutting accounts that have funds in them is now perfectly legal. And we've seen the test cases for this in Cyprus, and it's not pretty because the liabilities are staggering. And which is why Bitcoin is such an important and valuable asset. It is the incredible power of Bitcoin that it is an independent, apolitical asset, that politics can't steal its value from you. It can attempt to regulate it or tell you how you can do this or that with it, but it's not inherent to the system. They don't have the control over the system. A degree of control over the physical world, or the on-ramps and off-ramps and that sort of thing. They have the legacy financial system, which you really cannot You can't fully avoid yet. It's a huge pain in the butt to avoid the legacy financial system at the moment. But I think those things will get there. I think this article is a really interesting. It's just a really quick, like, what are the main problems of a cashless society? The omnipresence of anyone in a position of government, which is just normal people. It's just normal people. You know, like, if you're looking at somebody who is going through, like, we'll see Social Security numbers and personal data of all these people. Why, if they're working at Apple, would you suspect that they're going to leak it? But if they're working for government, they don't. Is everybody you know who works in government just that better of a person? I don't know anybody that's just any different from anyone else I know. Like, it's just people. If they have access to the information, if there is no protection against that information, it will be used, it should be assumed that it will be used adversarially. It's the CASA can't do evil, won't do evil. Because if it's a situation where you're entirely reliant on someone else being the good guy in order for you to have your liberty, then you are not a free person. Because they're not going to be a good guy. Eventually, their goals are not going to line up with yours, and they are going to care a whole lot more about theirs than they are going to care about yours. The simple fact of reality. And it's not even an evil thing about humanity. It's just the fact that we are closer to us than somebody halfway across the country. You know, I don't know. I'm sure there is a person named Tom in California who wants to do something, and I am not going to be concerned with what they are trying to accomplish. My life is what's important to me. My family is what's important to me. This is not a flaw. This is the nature of the fact that there's too many things to focus on in the world. Therefore, you should only have to focus on your own life, your own accountability, and your own integrity. And if someone is put in a position where they can regularly abuse it to help their family, to help their friends, and never even really see or directly understand the consequences that other people... I mean, think about what can you really point directly at with negative interest rates? You're just going to see the economy get in worse and worse shape, debt's going way up, but you can't point to exactly this person was screwed over immediately by the negative interest rates that you did. It's just this huge general thing. It's like this equal way to abuse and corrupt everyone's economic interactions than it is with anybody else. And of course, the rich who understand money better and have available like capital markets and stocks and futures and all this stuff that the average person or obviously the poor have zero access to, the rich are not going to pay this bill. They do not pay. They won't pay for the negative interest rates. They will be going to Bitcoin. They will be going to assets, and they will find a way to make their money not get eaten away by negative interest. They'll just leave whatever country is screwing them. They don't need to stay in any particular borders. The world is global. The economy is global now. You can do business with all the major countries from practically anywhere. There's an increasing, strictly global economy, and it is the rich who have the money to just get on a plane, peace out. I'm no longer paying these negative interest rates. I'm going to move all my money out of here. And Bitcoin is exactly the thing that will enable that. But it should be something that's available to everyone. The government should be kept in check. Privacy, independent capital, and Bitcoin, fulfilling those two roles, hopefully privacy, we're getting there, is exactly what hedges against that kind of behavior. I think that's the most important role or fight that is happening in Bitcoin right now. That most people don't even think that this is a concern. You know, my government is hero government. It's all the other governments that are ones that screw people. If someone has suggested that they committed a crime, well, then they have to prove that they didn't, because obviously the government would never lie and the government would never just flatly be wrong about these kinds of things. So, you know, if they suspect someone of money laundering, well, then it's because that person has done something bad. They have done something to either disagree with or challenge or just make unhappy someone who works for a government authority position, and therefore they are by default in the wrong. And any attempt, any means that they have of defending themselves is going to be an exhausting multi-year battle, and their chances of success are slim to none. Cash is a lower bound on this, as they say in the article. Cash is a way to limit just how much they can take with negative interest rates. Cash is a way to limit just how much politically controversial behavior they can engage in. And you know what's always politically controversial? Telling about someone in government committing a crime. That is always politically controversial because it undermines our civilization. No, it doesn't. The crime undermined our civilization or the legitimacy of our justice system, which is kind of a misnomer, or an oxymoron. And that's why the most important elements, the most important characteristics of Bitcoin are in the fact that it can survive in the face of a government actor, India, China, the US, North Korea, whoever it may be, attacking it or attempting to basically implement this quote-unquote cashless society in an effort to control people for the goals of government. So if you see the obvious truth that governments are almost universally corrupt, that governments regularly abuse their authority, that authoritarianism is something that we don't want, that mass surveillance is not about what you have, about having something to hide. It's about not by default giving away all the information necessary to ruin your life. You don't have to be doing something criminal in order to have your life ruined by an invasion of your privacy. You don't have to be, like, at all. You can be, just a video of you having sex can ruin you publicly with all your friends and stuff. Who knows? Like maybe you've got some weird fetish. Like, the degree of any, it doesn't even have to be that extreme. It can be tiny, nothing things. It can be your private information. It's identity theft. Like, we use privacy. Privacy is our authentication mechanism for all of our finances. And someone who has the ability to authenticate themselves as you because you are under full surveillance is going to abuse that. It's going to happen. The only way to prevent it from happening, the only way to secure an economy against that, is to make a system where at its foundation you do not require giving up that information. That giving up the information is an extra step. That authentication can maintain privacy. That's the one of the other brilliant things about Bitcoin, even in the context that you can track or analyze the blockchain, is that it's pseudonymous. Your address, it's a push system. You're not giving someone all the authentication necessary to remove money from your account. Instead, you are pushing the money to them by signing with a private key that they never have access to. So you're never revealing anything when you are sending payments or when a payment is authorized on the network. And that's how the public-private key model is. That's how the Lightning Network works. That's how smart contracts work, if, of course, they are secure. So privacy is not just about, it's not about whether or not you're doing something right or wrong. That's kind of the point I'm trying to make. There are 1,000 different elements. Thus, the the marketing position that government has put between their control and surveillance over their people and the privacy of the people has been a black and white, a false dichotomy that either you are doing something criminal or we should be able to see everything that you do. And that is not the dichotomy. That is not, there is not a one-to-one dichotomy. There's not two stories or two sides to this coin. It is a many, many multifaceted a problem. And privacy is critical. We talked about it in a really great article that we read. Not sure what episode it was now. I need to go ahead and get my collection together of privacy topics because we have covered a lot of stuff on that. But that there's a degree of privacy that is core to being human. It's core to being who you are. And the analogy in the article that I read and the subsequent TED Talk that it was kind of inspired or working on the ideas from, wish I could remember who did it. I can't remember off the top of my head. I'll see if I can find it. But it was just about how, you know, like how many things do you do? How many you hum some stupid song that you just made up while you're doing the dishes, or you pick your nose, or, you know, pull the underwear out of your butt crack. Like it just, you know, there's a degree of being human that you just don't want everybody to see. You know, you don't have a glass door on your bathroom. You don't live in glass houses. There's a reason you can't see through walls. You don't want people seeing you take a shit. You're not committing a crime. You're not shooting heroin up in there. You're just taking a dump and you don't want people to see. So anyway, this rant has gone on way too long. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Again, take my passion with a grain of salt because, you know, not everybody agrees with me. And there are plenty of views out there, but I think I'm pretty sound in my logic. If you think I am wrong, I'd love to hear why. I love fleshing out these kind of ideas and the principles behind them, particularly the moral principle and the ideas of like negative interest rates and monetary controls being a form of hidden confiscation. You just don't see it. You don't know where it is that your value was confiscated or that your labor was directed toward a goal that was not in your interest and or was not something that you ever wanted to fund or do. And like so those ideas fascinate me because there's just such an integral, like a complex system that like it's a system that's stealing instead of just some specific, like, you know, it's not like somebody is going to everybody's house and stealing 2% of their savings, like, directly. It's just, it's invisible. But because of that, it's fascinating the incentives in play and how people try to cover it up or excuse the behavior and, you know, try to make some ridiculous claim that it's necessary to save the economy from ridiculous levels of debt to encourage people to go deeper into debt. But anyway, I've gone on too long. Okay, we will stop this here. I hope you guys enjoyed our introduction into the cashless society conversation. And we will be hitting more on privacy, and we will be hitting a really lengthy and awesome piece about the why electronic cash. It's like the case for electronic cash. I don't even remember what the heck it's called. But it's a really good, really good piece. I haven't even finished it yet. I'm like halfway through. But I'm loving it. So we will get there. Do not miss that. Make sure you subscribe and share this with everybody that you know in the Bitcoin and crypto economy space, because we will be hitting that sometime next week. And I think we're going to have a hell of a lot of fun with it. So I hope you will join me. I hope you will come back tomorrow because we'll have another episode. In the meantime, check out Hasu on Twitter and Suzu on Twitter as well. And check out Uncommon Core and or their Medium page. I'll actually link to the Medium page because you can specifically go drop some claps on this article. It's a good one, and they deserve, they're always doing awesome work. So it's much appreciated. It always gives me something fun to read and talk about. All right. Thank you guys so much for joining me. I will talk to you all tomorrow. This has been Guy and the Crypto Economy Podcast. Thank you for listening. Until next time. Take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.